This is Keeping the Faith on the Mormon Faircast. The Keeping the Faith series explores ways in which our faith can be challenged and ways in which we can overcome those challenges.
What other kinds of things do you think there are that can cause people to struggle or to lose faith?
You know, a really big one, and this has kind of a couple parts to it, is the idea that God should work in the world in the way that I expect, the way that I think I would act if I were in the position of God. You know, when I hear people say things that depend on that assumption, I'm always tempted to ask, have you looked at the world lately? You know, you were mentioning quantum mechanics, you know. Who in the world, who in their right mind, you know, would like, which of us would have come up with this seemingly crazy system that underlies everything that we do? You know, underlies the way that the whole world works. You know, as we look and we see that God allows people agency to do things that, you know, we don't allow people in our societies. You know, we have laws to punish people. You look at things like, you know, terrible things like the Holocaust, you know, and that it wasn't God doing it, but God didn't stop it. Like, I don't know which of us would think that if you put us in the position of God, that we would have acted the same way, you know? The truth is that we have no idea what it would be like to be in the position of God, you know? I mean, maybe we can get a small glimpse, actually, and that's, I think, part of what we're supposed to do is to learn divine perspective, but we can't assume at the outset that we already have it, that we already see the world the way that God sees it, and that what we expect that God will do is what God expects that God should do. You know, a couple areas where we have assumptions like this are with regard to prophets and revelation. So there's this assumption that a true prophet should be nearly perfect and have only trivial weaknesses.
Or no weaknesses.
Yeah, no weaknesses or trivial weaknesses. We give lip service to the idea that prophets are just men, that they have weaknesses. But when anyone ever points out something that looks like a real weakness, a substantive weakness, we like want to deny it or we're troubled by it. There's no reason for that. I mean, like, again, if people have an assumption like this, like, have you read the Bible? You know, I mean, Moses was guilty of manslaughter. He offended God so greatly that even after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness to get the children of Israel to the promised land, God wouldn't let him go in. The sons of Israel, you know, great spiritual giants like Judah and Reuben and Levi, right? I mean, they did some things that everybody would agree are really bad, really rotten, you know? These were God's chosen people. These are the people he chose to found the 12 tribes of Israel. David was chosen to be not only an ancestor of Christ, but to be a type of Christ. Messiah means anointed one. Well, it's building on the model of the Davidic kings having been anointed kings. So we know, you know, the things that he did. Solomon, who was chosen to build God's temple, he was hardly an ideal figure. So, you know, of course I'm not saying that this is what prophets on the whole are like, that they have to have terrible weaknesses. But I'm saying if God could choose and make use of these you know, our whole idea of what prophets are is really shaped by the Bible. But if you look at the biblical prophets, they're not these perfect or nearly perfect people that we imagine. They're not. And so I don't see why we should imagine that prophets and church leaders in our day should somehow magically be completely different than prophets were in olden days, that they shouldn't have real substantive weaknesses.
Yeah, that's an important one, as it goes back to, you know, so many people who say that they just can't believe this church is true because they find out something about Joseph Smith that they don't like, you know, and so that somebody's acting in a way that you don't imagine a prophet should be acting, and so the church must not be true, when nobody has ever set forth a model of a prophet as a perfect individual.
Right. It's, for a prophet to be imperfect isn't contradicting doctrine or the scriptures. In fact, it's going along very well with what we see in the biblical scriptures, you know. And I think we tend to have an assumption as Latter-day Saints that the difference between the prophet and us is that the prophet is so much more righteous than us, than everybody else, kind of. You know, I have absolutely no question but that Thomas S. Monson is a much better person than I am, you know, is far, far, far more charitable than I have learned to be, you know, and is much closer to God and his devotion. But there are many extremely righteous people in the church. What sets apart the prophet isn't that he has to be the most righteous person in the church. It's that the Lord needs someone who can do certain kinds of work. It's kind of like Paul's analogy of the body, right? One person's a hand, another person's a foot, somebody's a head, you know. We all have different functions. Well, God is not going to choose a hand to serve as the head, you know, or the foot or something, because it wouldn't make any sense. God chooses people who can do the work that he needs done. It takes different abilities to lead a church than it takes to be an everyday member of that church. And so prophets are chosen not only because they meet a high level of righteousness, but also because they have the abilities to do the work that God needs. Well, we also seem to tend to assume that Joseph Smith was even better than all these other prophets. You know, he had to be, like, what separates Joseph Smith from Thomas S. Monson is that he just had even far more faith and far more righteousness. Joseph Smith said things about himself where, you know, he said, like, I don't want you to think that I'm terribly righteous. You know, if I were, I'd be translated and you'd all be left here by yourselves, you know. It takes different abilities to start a religion, to start a dispensation, than it takes either to be an everyday member of the church or to be one of the subsequent leaders of that church. And so Joseph Smith was called by God partly because he was able to do the work that God wanted done. And so I don't think we need to assume that he needed, the difference between him and us is he just had to be so much more righteous that he was almost perfect. And so I think that assumption gets people into trouble.
The Doctrine and Covenants itself, it contains revelations from God chastising Joseph Smith for messing up, you know.
Sure.
And to the extent that a prophet is imperfect and weak, that helps to glorify God in that he can make weak things strong, miracles can take place through people who are imperfect.
Right. That gives hope for us, right? If God works through imperfect people, he can work through us. But if God doesn't, if God only uses the nearly perfect, we're all out of luck. How are we supposed to be instruments in his hands?
Right. What else do you see as things that maybe are stumbling blocks?
The assumptions that we have, I think about revelation and how it works. you know, there's a lot that I don't understand on this, so I don't claim to have fully the big picture. But from studying Joseph Smith and from reading the scriptures carefully, I think there's a picture of revelation that emerges that's different from what we a lot of times assume the process is like. It seems like we expect often that if something is revealed by God, it should have no input from the revelator, and it should have no resemblance to anything in the world around it, the surrounding environment. So first problem with that is that it would exclude biblical revelation from being real revelation, because, you know, you look at the different books of the different biblical prophets, they're in extremely different styles sometimes, which shows that there's obviously input from the prophet himself.
They're sometimes in different languages.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you know, it's not all in the pure Adamic tongue. It has to be, you know, transmitted through some language that is necessarily an imperfect form of communication.
Yeah, and it has to be, in a sense, translated for the culture that the people live in and according to their understanding, including the understanding of the prophet himself. In the Bible, too, the religion of the Israelites has a lot of similarities to the religion of some of the surrounding peoples in the land of Canaan. The Israelites even end up using, sometimes in the Hebrew scriptures, you have the name Baal, which is the name of one of the, you know, idolatrous gods that the Bible is always condemning the people for worshiping. You have it used as one of the God's titles. You have it used to mean Lord. Well, the Israelites obviously picked that up from their neighbors, you know? So even biblical revelation shows influence from the context that it's in. It makes use of the materials of the world surrounding it. It doesn't omit them, block them out. Also, building another problem with that assumption that gets people in trouble is you know, building up a church or creating a revealed text through a prophet, these are acts of divine creation. And, you know, if we look at the scriptures, how does God create? Well, if we look at LDS scripture, and particularly at the book of Abraham creation account, it's clear that God, he creates, first of all, God creates in community. So, you know, in the book of Moses, it describes the interactions of God and Christ in the creation. In the book of Abraham, it's describing this premortal divine council and their collective activities in cooperation with God, you know, in the creation. So creation is communal. And also, it's from pre-existing materials. They're organizing pre-existing matter. Well, if Mormonism is true, then, and if revelations are, or the God building up a church are a form of divine action, divine creation, then we should expect those things to follow the patterns of how we know from the scriptures that God creates. So we should expect, in that case, that God will create in cooperation with others rather than just as an isolated individual. So revelation is an interaction between God and the prophet. It's something Blake Osler, I think it was, has referred to what he calls a co-creative model of revelation. Revelation is a co-creation of God and the prophet. It's not something that God just creates by himself and drops onto the prophet's head. Also, on the same divine model of creation that we have in LDS scripture, creation is from pre-existing materials. So prophet then not only should be cooperating with God in creating the church, in creating a revealed text, but it should draw on pre-existing materials that are already in the prophet's mind and in the prophet's environment. And I think that's exactly what we see. You look at Doctrine and Covenants 9, giving Oliver Cowdery instructions of how to translate the Book of Mormon, and it's telling him to study it out in his mind. Well, study what out in his mind? He has to have something to start with in order to have something to think about.
What's the point of that? If God is simply, transmitting directly through his hands onto the page without going through his head first.
Right. So the model that we have of divine creation is one of creation, communal creation, cooperative creation, and creation from pre-existing materials. And the model of revelation that we have there in D&C 9 is a model that involves the materials of the prophet's own mind. And so this is exactly, I think, when people assume that revelation is just these packets of information dropped onto the prophet, without any...
Or dropped onto the page.
Yeah, or dropped onto the page, then they're setting up an expectation that isn't what the restoration itself, it's our own doctrine, our own scripture, would lead us to expect. And so if it's true, then we should expect that revelation will involve the prophet himself being involved in the process, and it's not just something separate from him. And we should expect that it will make use of materials around him. So if the Book of Mormon or the Book of Moses, the Book of Abraham have material in them that seems to connect with Joseph Smith's surrounding environment, the language is similar, there are other similarities, it seems to me that's what we ought to expect rather than having it be something terribly shocking and faith-destroying.
What else do you see that maybe causes trouble for people?
Those are probably the main assumptions. There are some other things. We've talked about kind of my own experience of trying to rely too much on one mode of knowledge, and maybe not even the most relevant mode of knowledge. If we're seeking spiritual truth, then we should use spiritual means of discerning truth. That doesn't mean that we don't also use our minds, but we can't lay aside the spiritual means of discerning truth and still expect that we're going to find what we're looking for.
Yeah, so don't rely too much on one mode of knowledge. I mean, even spiritual knowledge. I mean, it seems to me that the scriptures teach us that, we're to worship God with our heart, might, mind, and strength.
Right.
And that if we were only to rely on our heart, that we could be led astray.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we need to be able to calibrate the knowledge that we're receiving through different modes so that, I heard one critic of the church recently talking about the idea of personal revelation and, the feelings of the Spirit coming to us and giving us knowledge and saying, well, then what good is the prophet? Or, why do you think you need the scriptures if you're able to receive, revelation on everything? It's a good point. You really do need to have the scriptures and modern prophets and personal revelation and our experiences and logic and, empirical evidences. And we're able to take all of these and, calibrate them against one another to help guide us toward the truth. And I think where we go astray is in making one paramount to the exclusion of all the others, throwing out anything that, science may say because of a feeling I have, or throwing out something that the prophet may say because of something I read in the scriptures, or vice versa. I think that all of these things are intended to work together, and it seems to me that that's what the scriptures are telling us. That's what Oliver Cowdery was being taught, I think, about studying it out in your mind, you know, and then praying about it, and, you know, see if you have a feeling that confirms what you've studied out, and that that helps lead us toward knowledge. We use all of our faculties.
And if, you know, if revelation does require studying things out in our minds, and if God does make use of pre-existing materials in our minds and our environment, then the more we set about to acquire knowledge in various ways, the more we give God to work with in the first place, you know? Stephen Covey had this idea of what he called having an educated conscience. So he said that it wasn't enough just to listen to the promptings of your conscience. You really needed first, and along with that, to educate your conscience, to go to read scriptures, to read things that would make sure that your moral compass was set right. And then when you had an educated conscience, then you could rely that much more fully on what your conscience tells you.
Right, or maybe another way of saying that is become educated about what your conscience is, you know, so that you can distinguish between different kinds of feelings that you may have. You know, so is a feeling I have of anger and hatred of God, you know, is that something that's, you know, this feeling that's it's making me feel like I want to hit somebody, is that revelation? Or you know, this feeling that's, you know, making me get all teary inside, you know, is that from God, or is that some emotion that I'm feeling that's independent of God? You know, and so I've heard people say that they can't rely on the feelings that they have inside as revelation because, you know, I'm watching The Little Mermaid and getting all teary-eyed, and so how can I know that, you know, emotions that bring me to tears aren't just the same thing that a Walt Disney movie is doing? And I mean, I think that the scriptures and the prophets give us guidance on how to educate ourselves about our conscience and about revelation so that we know that the feelings that are leading us toward Christ are the ones that are helping us to know what God wants us to do. The feelings that are leading us to love and to have faith and hope and peace, you know, that as we do things that are good and feel those feelings, and as we testify of truth and we feel those feelings, that and we start to get experience on how to recognize those feelings. But then again, it depends upon listening to what the prophets are saying, reading what the scriptures are saying, and then seeing that all these things align. And as they do align, we find they point to Christ, and so that we can know that they're good.
I think this this reminds me of something I mentioned earlier about wisdom. There are some things that can be learned by rote. You know, most subjects, you can, if you go over them and over the material again and again, you'll learn it. We don't know of any way where, like, life wisdom can be learned by rote. You know, life wisdom is learned by experience and by reflecting on our experience. It's something that it has a practical dimension. We have to put ideas into practice in order to really learn and gain, distill wisdom from our lives. Learning this, what Joseph Smith called learning the spirit of revelation, I think it's not like rote learning. It's like learning wisdom. And so
it's very experiential.
Yeah, right. If we're hoping for a simple process, if we're hoping that somebody can give us one infallible rule that's going to tell us when we're really being led by the Spirit or when we're not, then we're going to have a hard time, you know, because that's not the way it works. But to reject religious experience, to reject revelation for that reason, would be like rejecting wisdom. Would be like saying, well, you know, I don't want to pursue wisdom because you can't just explain to me how to do it. Or you can't just, I can't just read a book over and over and pick up all the principles of wisdom that I need. It's because it's a different kind of learning. It's an experiential learning. It doesn't work the same way as some of these other domains of learning.
Yeah, and sometimes we make mistakes, you know, and so you're trying to work this out, trying to figure it out, and so you're following this, you know, idea or, you know, flash of inspiration or instinct that you have, and it doesn't help you out, you know, it's something, it fails miserably, and so then you start comparing, you know, the process that you went through with the process that was fruitful. And over time, you know, just as you grow in wisdom, you also grow in the ability to recognize God's voice. Mm-hmm. So as we think about your experience and, you know, all the things that we've talked about here, what advice would you have for family members or for friends or for church leaders who encounter somebody who is struggling with their faith?
You know, there would be several things that I would say, based on my own experience and based on a lot of observation of other people who've gone through complicated spiritual journeys. The first thing that I would say is to accept them. To accept the person who's doubting or struggling, it makes sure that acceptance is clear to the person. I think a lot of times people end up being driven away because they realize they're not understood, or they feel unwelcome, or because there are condemnations, there are assumptions that they must be sinning or something if they're doubting. I think it's important to realize that if there's someone you know who is doubting or not believing, if you don't accept them, there are others who will accept them. If believers won't accept doubters, then they'll seek company, the company of other non-believers who will accept them. This happens all the time. So unless you really want to drive them into the arms of non-believers who are going to help cement their non-belief rather than change it, you need to make clear to them that you accept them.
By accept them, you mean that you still love them, that you want to have fellowship with them.
Yeah,
I guess rather than you know, the path you're choosing is a good one, and
sure,
you know,
right.
I support what
right.
you're doing.
I'm not talking about affirming things that you disagree with. I'm talking about still accepting the person. So, like when we talk about unconditional love, you know, Christ-like love, we don't mean that Christ approves of every wrong thing that we may do.
Yeah, whatever you do is okay with me.
Right.
It's that, in spite of the things you're doing that I don't agree with, I still love you.
Right. And there's nothing that we can do. I think it's Paul who said, I wish I could quote it exactly, but he said something like, I'm convinced that neither heights nor depths nor whatever else it was he said can separate us from the love of Christ. And, you know, we need to have that kind of love and acceptance. Just people need to know that we're not, even if we disagree with what they're thinking and doing, that we don't reject them as people somehow because of that. Another thing is, I think it's important to realize that this is, I think, is not common knowledge, because people who haven't left the church or been around others who have left the church wouldn't have this experience. But realize that there are some somewhat predictable phases that people go through when they lose their faith and leave the church. And one of those is that they tend to go through a phase where maybe they're kind of more obnoxious. As, you know, the church, it's not only a religious faith, it's also a culture. And as a culture, we're really good at instilling a sense of identity in people. If you ask a Mormon, sort of like, who are you? What defines you? And probably being a Mormon would be somewhere very high on their list, you know. That's not true with every religion. You know, if you're a Lutheran, you're probably not really strongly defined by your sense of Lutheranism. If people come to believe that the church isn't true and feel like they need to get some distance from it or separate from it, they will tend to feel like they need, just psychologically, they will feel like they're still Mormon unless they take actions to kind of separate themselves from it. So, you know, ex-Mormons all have their stories of like their first cup of coffee or the first time that they went and bought, you know, just regular everyday underwear, things like that, you know. And a lot of them on the Recovery from Mormonism board that we mentioned earlier, a lot of these people who are just in the process of leaving the church or just left, they go there. And they spout off all sorts of obscenities and horrible things. They mock sacred, you know, things that used to be sacred to them. And, you know, I wouldn't defend that behavior. But I do think it may help to understand why they're doing it, and that for most of those people, that's not a lasting life course. That's a temporary phase. And so, you know, if you've got, you know, if your brother-in-law leaves the church and he's always ragging on the general authorities and, you know, and has a ridiculing attitude and everything, most cases, the great majority of cases, that's not going to continue indefinitely. Once the person has established a kind of sense of a new identity, you know, as someone who's not Mormon, then they won't feel the need to be rebelling against their identity as a Mormon. It's sort of like an adolescent phase or something. So I think maybe just realizing that sort of thing is temporary.
It's very much like in a family or in a friendship that somebody has died or that somebody new has moved into the neighborhood or come into the family that you have to get to know again. Mm-hmm. And that could be really upsetting to a friend or a family member. And they're trying to, you know, they're trying to figure out what to do. And it seems that really what it is the process now of mm-hmm. trying to get to know this new person. And like you said, they go through this, you know, these phases that, in many ways, may mirror the kinds of phases that a new convert goes mm-hmm. through to the gospel, mm-hmm. where they feel like they want to share what they've learned with everybody and start testifying, you know, of their newfound faith, so that somebody who's left the church wants to feel like they want to testify of their newfound disbelief and, you know, right. I want to tell you all these things I've learned. And so I guess just as somebody who's a convert, you know, starts to go through this period where they kind of even out in their relationships with everyone else, somebody who is deconverted probably usually goes through that same kind of process where eventually the relationships are normalized and this person that you had known before, you know, now maybe in a little bit different way, but you can still have a good relationship with them.
Yeah, I think that's a really good analogy. I think there are some similar processes that someone who's converting and someone who's deconverting go through. Someone who's converting, they're taking on a new identity as a Latter-day Saint. Someone who is deconverting is taking on a new identity as a non-Latter-day Saint, you know? And not everybody, some people don't go through these phases as much as other people. You know, some people, they leave the church and they're not.
Don't feel compelled to go and get angry about it.
Some people just are really over the top. But again, I think just, yeah, recognizing, seeing it as a phase and realizing that it really is, in my experience of observing people who go through this, it's really pretty predictable, you know.
Well, you know, the thing that a lot of people are going to be wondering is, what can we do, you know? And part of the problem, I think, is identifying when this process is happening, you know, because it seems that so often when somebody starts to lose their faith, that they're pretty quiet about it. You know, they're not really out there telling everybody, man, I found this information out and it's shaking my faith. By the time they start talking about it, it seems like what they're doing is announcing, I've right. left, my faith is gone. And so then, you know, we're scrambling, trying to figure out what to do, arguing with them.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you think that we can do, I guess, how can you recognize when that's starting, and what should you do at that early point?
You know, there was, I think it was Hippocrates, the Greek doctor, who said, had this rule, first, do no harm. If someone is struggling with their faith, the first thing to do is to not make it worse. And this goes back to, like, accepting the person. And I think one of the things that drives people away or pushes them further down this path is that we tend to have a lot of assumptions about doubters and people who stop believing. There are the assumptions like they only doubt because they want to sin. They don't believe because they don't want the church to be true. That assumes an awful lot. It assumes that we really know what's going on in someone else's mind and heart without actually being in the position to make that judgment. God is in the position to make that judgment. And so why don't we leave that judgment to Him and do what we can to help the person in the meantime? Rather than accusing someone of sinning or of not wanting to believe, why don't we take a more positive approach and encourage them to live the things in the gospel that they know? You know, most people, even who are doubting and even some who disbelieve, there are aspects of the gospel that really have rung true to them. Maybe some of the things that they're taught about how to treat other people or things like that. I think we don't want to drive the people away. We want to encourage them along the path towards something good.
Yeah, I mean, what I hear you saying is that we want to encourage them to strengthen or maybe reform their connection with God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so if they still have some kind of, you know, faith in Christ, or they still have a belief that, you know, they want to be together with their families forever, or things like that, that we encourage them in those beliefs and help them to kind of reconnect. So what kinds of things do you think people could have noticed about you when you started down that path? You know, what kind of signals were you sending that somebody maybe could have picked up on had they recognized them?
That's a really good question. Well, I continued to go to church for a while, but I became somewhat more withdrawn at church. I would bring other things to read, you know. I changed somewhat how I presented myself in terms of, like, my hair and whatnot, you know, got longer in the back and so on.
Why is that? Was that part of kind of disengaging, kind of,
well,
you know?
In my case, it was very conscious because I wanted to change what people expected of me.
So it was part of sending a signal.
Yeah. I felt like I looked the part of the returned missionary, and I'd been in the ward that I was in for a while, and I thought, when I open my mouth, people are going to expect me to say the most orthodox possible thing. And I didn't want them to expect that because that's probably not what I was going to say. I think sometimes people may do things like that, change their appearance or something, because they're starting to identify with a different social group.
Yeah, it's a subtle way of communicating.
They're adopting norms of that particular social group.
Right. And they're communicating that this is happening by changing their appearance.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if they're trying to sort of disengage with the Orthodox Mormon social group, then maybe they're wearing, you know, a red shirt to church, or, yeah, you know, you can start, you know, put some earrings in, or, you know, longer hair.
Right.
And maybe those things are not communicating a loss of faith, but maybe they are. And so, or maybe somebody starting to complain a lot. You know, about, yeah, you know, grousing about what the bishop said or did, or complaining about something said in general conference. And so these things might signal some issues that are starting to emerge. So what would you suggest somebody do if they start to recognize some of those types of signals? I guess, I mean, would this just go back to what you were saying before about helping them to strengthen their connection to God, you know, and finding ways that they're comfortable with, you know, things that they are maybe already doing. So somebody, you know, maybe the only thing they're really happy to do in church is home teach, you know, and you happen to be the home teaching companion, that you try to make that a really productive, positive experience,
yeah,
for them.
Yeah. Build on, I would say, to, again, to accept them and make sure that they know that they're accepted, to build on whatever positives you can, because a lot of times when we try to combat negatives, we actually just make the problem worse. And part of the reason for that is that going into combat with something is a negative action to begin with. And so it will tend to enhance negatives instead of diminish them.
So you don't go up and challenge somebody as to why they've grown their hair out, you know, or what are you doing wearing a red shirt in church?
Right. Unless you want them, again, unless you want them to feel rejected,
right,
and leave. Yeah.
So you don't take on that. Instead, you try to embrace them more, you know, and try to draw them more in, rather than saying, this person's rejecting me by wearing a different color shirt, so I'm going to reject them. You know, or maybe this person wants a fight, you know, and so I'm going to stay away from them. And so by pushing people away, then we're accelerating their exit from the church.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I see this all the time, too. I don't spend nearly as much time these days on the internet message boards, but I've seen it a lot there. Someone will come on to the message board with some doubts or with some questions or with, not even necessarily that, but sometimes just some different ways of viewing some things in our faith. And so often people will jump so quickly to the assumption that this person is an enemy, or that they're on their way out and they just kind of need to be shown the door, or they need to be knocked over the head, you know. I think one of the dangerous assumptions that we sometimes have about doubters is that they are on their way out, that if somebody is raising questions, if they're complaining about things or whatever, then boy, they're just going to become an apostate and leave the church. You know, people often jump really quickly to those kinds of conclusions, you know, online and in wards and whatever. And partly those become like self-fulfilling prophecies, because we behave differently toward people when we have that kind of assumption. We, we're not supposed to act, you know, Jesus didn't go around acting on his worst fears. He acted on his hopes. So if people were doing cruel and unkind things, he didn't approach them with the attitude that, boy, they're only going to get worse. He saw the potential that they had to get better, and he tried to act in such a way as to bring out the best in them. I think if we try to act in ways, if we hold out hope instead of acting so much on our fears, and if we just act in ways that try to bring out the best in doubters and in everyone, then we'll tend to get more of the best.
Yeah.
From those people.
Well, and so the man who comes to Christ and says, well, Christ says, do you believe? And he says, I believe, help thou my unbelief.
Right.
Christ doesn't say, wait, what is this about your unbelief?
Right.
You know? And so maybe when somebody is expressing doubts or fears or criticisms, maybe that is expressing a more, you know, deep-seated problem that needs to be rooted out. Maybe it doesn't, but in either case, it seems that what we should be doing is not pushing that person away,
right,
and instead embracing that person, right, more. So what other kinds of things do you think that we can do to help family or friends who maybe seem to be struggling with their faith? Or maybe you're asking for help.
I would say one of the biggest things is to hold out hope. Even if someone has completely left the church, and if they completely don't believe, you know, that's where I was, and not that long ago. And I quote unquote knew, right, that I wasn't coming back, and I had completely given up and closed the door and locked it behind me, you know. And I could not have foreseen what would happen. I gave up on God, but God did not give up on me. And so, you know, we need to be the same way. We should be like God. We can hold out hope for people. No matter how far gone they seem, there are people who have come back from even farther, you know. And so we shouldn't write people off. And, you know, that means being patient, because sometimes people don't come around for a long time. And, you know, I guess sometimes they don't come around until after this life. But there's every reason to hold out hope, because we know that even if the person has given up on the church, even if they've given up on God, God hasn't given up on them. And there will always be opportunities in the future for them to come back.
So what would you say to the person who's listening to this now, who's going through this and thinking, I wonder if the church is true, or I don't think the church is true?
Right. I would say, first of all, kind of to overlap some with what I was saying to family and friends, I would say to rely on what you do know. If you don't know that, you know, the priesthood was restored, or that this is the only true church, if you don't know that the Book of Abraham is scripture, or some, you know, that Thomas S. Monson holds all the keys of the priesthood, or whatever. If you have been in the church for very long, if you have any desire to be in the church, then you've had experiences of goodness, and you've had experiences of the Spirit. And sometimes maybe people like I did will reinterpret those experiences and won't even see them as the Spirit. But they're certainly experiences of something good, right? If you experience love, peace, joy things like that, these are what we mean by good. And so if you've experienced things like that, if you've experienced things that have made you want to do good, have made you a better person, rely on those things. Focus on those things. Those things, that's the seed to nourish. Don't nourish the seeds of doubt, of having like a troubled mind over difficult things, over grievances. You know, if church leaders maybe have said something that you don't feel you can agree with, build on what you do know, and focus on living the best that you know from the gospel. You know, the gospel has so many beautiful things in it, and the church provides us opportunities to connect with others and opportunities to serve. Take advantage of the opportunities that the church offers to serve, and, you know, take advantage of the wisdom that it has to offer about how to live. You know, follow, you know, one of the most frequently talked about things, some of the most frequently talked about things at General Conference are service and being Christ-like. You know, I think there are few people who reject those principles. So, you know, focus on, find things that your heart really is in, and focus on living those. I know from my own experience that when you doubt, it's easy to make your doubts your new focus, you know, and just try to keep digging to the bottom of church history issues or other issues as if those were the center of the world, or if those, as if those were the whole gospel, and they're not. They're a tiny aspect of things. So I think my experience would have been much better if I had not let struggling with doubt sort of take over my world for a while, you know. But if I had, you know, experienced those doubts, but found a way to focus really on the things that I do know and the things that I could, in good conscience, you know, really fully live in my life.
You know, it reminds me of the story that I heard of the Native American man who's talking to his young son. He's telling him how there are two wolves inside of us that are fighting. You know, there's a black wolf and a white wolf. And the young boy asks, which one wins? And he said, the one that you feed.
Right, right.
And it seems that that's true in so many ways, but it sounds
the one you feed will win. So be careful. Be careful and choose consciously what you're going to feed. Along with that, I would say, you know, really just try to, I mentioned this earlier, you know, but like in my own life, you know, it's one thing to read the scriptures, to think of, you know, reading the scriptures, and it's another thing to approach it as seeking the Spirit through the scriptures. That gives a whole different approach and has a whole different feeling to it. And I think, in my experience, certainly it's been a more fruitful way to build my relationship with God and to ground myself spiritually. I would say maybe try to be aware of how and why the things that you say in the context in which you say them might be threatening to other people's faith. Because people's faith is so vitally important to them, you know, it's part of their sense of who they are and of what's of ultimate importance in life. And so, you know, if we experience doubts or problems and we express them in a way that, or in a place that makes others feel threatened, then then they'll probably act threatened, and then you may feel sort of pushed away. You know, so for instance, like Sunday school class, obviously, you know, isn't the place to raise, you know, issues about Joseph Smith's polygamy or something like that. I would say to seek, also to seek the company of accepting believers rather than of people who are disgruntled. It's really natural for us as human beings to seek the company of people who understand us. And, you know, there are some groups out there that sort of gather together people who feel marginal or disgruntled or doubting. And I think what tends to happen, the dynamic of that, is that we tend to become more like the people that we're around. And they may be good people, but if they're in a place in their lives that's not the place that we want to be, then kind of integrating ourselves into that group is not going to lead us in the direction that we want to go. And so, you know, if you can find others who believe, who have faith, but who can maybe understand somewhat where you are and, you know, express their understanding, then that's a lot better course to follow than to go and sort of hang out with people who are disgruntled and who your experience is likely to be much more pleasant too if you're not hanging around with groups of people who are really in the throes of disillusionment and being disgruntled. You can improve your own experience and, you know, keep yourself closer to the church if you, again, if you seek the company of believers who can empathize. I think the last thing that I would say is when I was making my own return to the church, I really had to have a fundamental shift in attitude from the time that I left to the time that I returned. When I left, I really was disillusioned, and I saw the negative. The negative really came to the foreground for me. And that's the way that disillusionment is. We tend to, when we're disillusioned, we tend to focus on negatives. When I came back to the church, I knew that that's not where I wanted to be. I wasn't coming back to the church because there were sometimes comments that I would disagree with in Sunday school, or because there were difficult issues in church history, or because there were aspects of Mormon culture that I didn't like. I was coming back because of positive, beautiful, wonderful things. And so those really are the things that I want to have dominate my experience. And we tend to, to a great extent in life, we create our own experience based on what we focus on. And so, you know, and through the questions that we ask ourselves. And so if I ask myself what's good and what's beautiful and what works in the church and in my fellow Latter-day Saints, then I experience very different things than if I ask myself what doesn't work or what is messed up. You know, if someone, even if you've encountered difficult things, you will tend to find in the church and in other Latter-day Saints, you'll tend to find more and more of what you nourish over time with your attention. Our attention, giving our attention to something, it waters it, it feeds it. And so be aware of which wolf you're feeding or which plant you're feeding. You know, is it the wheat or is it the tares? An analogy that I like, that I got from someone else, is suppose you're approaching a hill, and at the top of this hill there's a tree. and behind the tree is the full moon. When you're at the bottom of the hill or when you're far off, the tree will appear very tiny compared to the moon. But if you get up and you go climb up the hill and you're standing right in front of the tree, looking at the tree, that tree can crowd out the moon so that you don't even see the light of the moon. It looks like the tree is bigger than the moon from that vantage point, but it's only because you've gotten yourself so close to the tree that you're allowing so much of your attention to go to it. You're allowing it to fill the whole your whole field of vision. In reality, of course, you know, the moon is so vastly larger. We do that with things sometimes, and sometimes we do that maybe with things related to the church or the gospel. The church is this enormous, beautiful light, and yet if we choose to get our minds so close to and enmeshed in negatives and problems, we can allow those to fill our whole field of vision until they eclipse the moon, you know, and they make it look like the problems are bigger when they're anything but. The gospel is filled with so many beautiful, wonderful things and so much light that it would just be a shame to, you know, to crowd that out by keeping the negative too close and giving too much of our focus and attention to that. And you know, sometimes this is something that I have to remind myself of, but I can't tell you how much difference it's made in my life.
Don Bradley, thank you for joining us on the Mormon Faircast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Mormon Faircast. If there is an issue that you've been wondering about, you can often find the latest answers at the Fair Wiki, found at fairmormon.org. If you can't find your answer there, feel free to pose your question to the Fair Apologists by visiting the Fair contact page. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help increase the popularity of this podcast by subscribing in iTunes and by writing a review. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Paul Cardall. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of FAIR.